Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends, plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Today, Sean Kiernan, CEO of Green Gauge, talks to Andrea Tignano for a high-level overview of legal and regulatory developments in the USA. Andrea is an attorney, consultant, and entrepreneur who has been dubbed the blockchain czarina for her role in bringing blockchain to Delaware and securing the first states in primature on the nascent technology. Sean and Andrea discuss whether there is still life in the Lummis-Gillibrand bill or any potential successor, what's happening with the SEC and CFTC, is collaboration a possible way forward? And last but not least, they look at where Andrea sees the USA's role in the global fintech scene and whether there is anything the UK can do to support a positive innovation environment in the US.
Andrea, really excited to have you with us today on The Gauge. You and I have known each other for some time, initially when you were with IOV Labs, our biggest investor. You've now gone portfolio, still with IOV, but it'd be great to hear some of your background and why we're having the discussion today.
Sure. Happy to be here. I'm a Delaware lawyer, and I had a very traditional career. I worked for a judge in the Court of Chancery. I worked for a well-known law firm for a few years. I went in-house as an assistant general counsel. I worked there for 11 years, a global corporate services company. I got promoted to VP of Business Development. So I was using both sides of my brain for several years. And then I had an opportunity to go work for the state of Delaware. They invited me to join their Department of State. And I was the head of a division they created for me called the Division of Corporate and International Corporate Development. And while I was there, I learned about blockchain technology, and I just thought it was insane, just this idea of decentralized systems that didn't need a third party. And so I dug into that, learned a lot, and in a very short time, got everyone on board that this was important and Delaware should do something about it. And so, including the governor and the secretary of state and the top lawyers in the state, and we launched something now referred to as the Delaware Blockchain Initiative. We got laws passed in the state to allow business entities, corporations, LLCs, partnerships to be able to maintain their corporate records on a distributed ledger. And so the statute doesn't say blockchain, but in the preamble, it discusses that. But the impact is that any business entity in Delaware can maintain records on a distributed ledger on a blockchain. And we were the first jurisdiction to do that, to really come out in favor anywhere in the world, in favor of this technology. We found it credible and important. And so that was kind of a touchstone for a lot of other work that was done around the world. I worked for the state for 4 years. I was in and out because the new governor came in, and even though he was of the same party, he just didn't buy it. And so even though the laws got changed, we had all sorts of big plans to put corporate registrations on a distributed ledger, all sorts of other filings. I mean, really, just we had some really great plans, and I had done some extensive projections on what additional services could mean to the state of Delaware. I was brought in to do economic development. So that was what I thought. I thought, wow, this blockchain technology, decentralized data on a decentralized network, I thought this would be a big economic driver. And in fact, it would have been. It has been for many other places, not Delaware. There will be a new governor soon, and maybe that new governor will be interested in the millions and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars that taking the data, digitizing it, making it available, and just some more contracts could do for the state. Yeah, so I left. And after that time, I was consulting, and I had an opportunity to work with IOV Labs as their chief legal officer. And that's where we got to know each other. And IOV Labs originated in South America, although it's fairly global at this point. It's reached the UK, of course. And that company created and launched a layer two on the Bitcoin blockchain and is developing a tool so that others can build on that platform. So that's pretty cool. And I was there for a year and a half, maybe a little more. And then I had an opportunity to join Global Blockchain Business Council. I'm their chief legal officer, head of policy, Americas. So I'm speaking out to you in my personal capacity, not as a representative of the organization. I need to make that clear. And I also do some advising. As you mentioned, I'm still an advisor at IOB Labs, and I advise other clients as well, and some of whom are doing some pretty exciting things. So I'm all in on DLT and blockchain and digital assets. I believe it is the future. I think it has the capacity to change the world for the good, really for the good. And what fascinates me as a lawyer is that our legal systems, our laws, our regulations were not set up for this. They were set up to regulate people and organizations whom they know. And so I think in the law, we're seeing some really, this is really an exciting time. Some people might say it's a devastating time because we're not moving fast enough. But, you know, the law, most laws in democratic societies developed over hundreds and hundreds of years. And this technology is, you know, since what, 2008? So it's fairly new. So we're seeing the growing pains in every area.
It's lovely to see your excitement. I think the big smile and also the journey, one of advocacy and pushing actually some interesting things through in Delaware. And now here at a more national purview.
Global. Yeah. What's exciting is the GPC has a global reach. They work with regulators around the world. The idea is to bring about best practices. We're not looking to come up with some sort of renegade, I don't know, process or body of law that's just going to screw everything up. No, it's not like go out and break things. We don't want to break things.
No, build things, it sounds.
Build things, and do things better, more efficiently. There have been a lot of rent takers, right? Yeah. Since the beginning of time, people made their money. They owned the bridge, right? They took their toll. They own the building. They own the wires to allow transmissions to take place. They took their cut. That's how the world developed. And now there's a technology that enables transactions to happen without a third party. No rent takers, or the rent takers are, it's minimal. It's so much less and frankly, faster, more efficient. But yeah, but like, what do you do when you can't hold someone, some person, some company responsible? I can tell you first, I mean, I'm watching how governments are struggling, grappling with this all over the world. And it's a challenge. It's not easy. And we're starting to, you know, we're seeing it in the lawsuits that are being brought.
Which is also very interesting. I know that you have both an international and a national hat, being a U.S. citizen and having cut your teeth in Delaware. We're hearing a lot. And you are our first American guest, so I'm honored to have you on the cage.
I feel honored. Thank you.
And being American myself, it's a joy. But if I could ask, we're hearing so much of what's going on in the U.S. and everyone is talking about SEC, CFTC, the various political discussions at Congress. I'm going to give you the most difficult challenge to say from a high-level perspective, where are we? What are we looking at?
It's messy. It's really, really messy because we have the federal government. We have two governments in this country, right? We have the feds and we have the states. The Fed overlays the states and the federal law can preempt state law. So we have the federal legislators and they all want to protect the people. They want to protect, on the one hand, the interests of the American citizens. They don't want to stifle growth. They want the U.S. to continue to be a destination for innovators and entrepreneurs, as it's always been. On the other hand, they want to protect the markets. We have the biggest market in the world. The U.S. market is considered the safest, most secure market in the world. They don't want to screw that up. So you have different groups of people. And I'm not saying even groups like Republicans and Democrats, because although it's a bit politicized, there are different approaches. Some people are emphasizing safety and security. Others are emphasizing more growth and innovation. And they are really struggling to come up with something that achieves both goals. On the one hand, keeping secure our markets, keeping people safe, protecting their interests, and also still being a destination spot for innovation entrepreneurs. So on the federal side, there's, you know, the SEC is really clamping down on its assertion that most tokens are securities. You have the CFTC that's vying for additional power. They want the authority to regulate fungible tokens, digital fungible digital assets. They want that authority. That's been pretty clear by all of their statements and assertions and testifying. That's what they want. For the most part, the Republicans would like to give that to them, would like them to have that authority. I think there's a perception that the CFTC would be a lighter touch, but I don't really think so. And still on the federal side, you have the SEC bringing a whole lot of enforcement actions in ways that might not be direct. So they're, you know, they would just rejected a filing by Grayscale to create a fund for based with Filecoin's tokens. And I said those tokens are a security camp, but they didn't go after Filecoin. It's always been indirect. It's like, you know, they bring a lawsuit against a former employee of Coinbase and they assert certain tokens on Coinbase, you know, are security. So we've got these sort of it's been a strange ride. It's been interesting to watch. So that's on the Fed side. So you've got a very aggressive SEC. And then meanwhile, the SEC is proposing these rules that would really hamstring the crypto industry. They have a very unpopular proposal out there about safeguarding digital assets, which for the most part would really throttle, would make it very, very difficult for institutional investors to do anything in with digital assets. They just proposed another rule to expand the definition of an exchange to include, you know, communication protocols, that would include decentralized protocols. So you've got that. And then at the states, you've got, you know, different states actually taking different measures. Some states are very crypto friendly. Some states are trying to ban mining, like, you know, the state of New York. And I think Pennsylvania now has a proposed statute out there that would really hamper the ability to do mining in Pennsylvania. And you have different states trying to, again, I think they're trying to protect the interest. Not that I think they are trying to protect the interests of their residents. In New York, for example, you have the BitLicense that's been out for several years, almost since the beginning, I think since 2015, when it was first introduced, people thought, oh my God, these requirements, that's crazy. But, you know, they stood their ground and they, you know, all sorts of capital requirements and background checks and requirements against deceptive marketing. I mean, just every aspect, almost, they have licensing requirements, audits, visits. And actually, when you had the implosion, the FTX implosion and all the other issues, all the other really bad stuff that happened last year, a lot of New Yorkers were hurt, but not quite as many as would have been. They were largely insulated from these debacles, to put it mildly. So yeah, you've got the federal feds doing their thing. You've got the states. It's not calm waters here in the US, not at all. I think people feel like it's not an easy place to do business, fraught with risk and uncertainty. So people in the US are looking, you were saying everybody in England or in Europe are looking what's going on in the US, and everyone in the US is sort of looking at Europe going, oh, they're looking at, well, the EU, somehow all those member states got together and they created, you know, MiCA regulations, like, how'd that happen? And then you've got the UK. We hear from across the Atlantic, like, the UK wants crypto. They want innovation. They want us. This could be the place. Like, this could be the new place for a home for innovation. So yeah, that's really high level in a nutshell. I could zoom in. I mean, I have a list of just so many. The latest, the Tornado Cash litigation. Like I said, from a lawyer, some of these cases are really interesting from a legal perspective. From the big picture, it's just like, my friends who are in this space, the lawyers who are working with clients, are just shaking their head going, this is terrible.
The grass is always greener, isn't it? I think it's a fantastic overview. I've not heard one as clearly or succinctly presented. And I think the Tornado Cash case is very interesting, as code is being now treated like a legal person.
Yes,
in a way.
Yes.
I'd love to hear your view.
Sure. Well, I'm going to be honest. I haven't read all the briefs, and I was reading the last brief filed, and I thought it was fascinating because I'm going to teach a course in the fall. And when I say the fall, I mean like in August, like not very long. And I'm putting together the syllabus. And what was so exciting to me about reading this brief, and I have it here, which is that it's all about it really turns on the definition of property. Like, what is property? And is a decentralized protocol, is that property that is actually owned by people? If it's not owned, can it be owned? And is it controlled by the token holders and only token holders or token holders who vote? I mean, this is what governments and courts are grappling with. And what's so interesting to me is that I remember the definition of property from my first year law class, you know, the intent and the ability to possess. That's the indicia of, if I remember, I mean, common law of owning property. And so I'm looking at this and I think what we're going to see, because as I mentioned earlier, you know, the laws grew up around the notion of having an intermediary, organizations, companies, people owning stuff. I mean, there are from way back, I think, principles of common ownership, like the grounds, the common ground. But then you have this notion of the king, right, owning everything that isn't owned by everybody else. So things revert to the sovereign. But in this case, you know, this question about tornado cash, it's code that's out there. It's never been revised. People can use it, but no one person can change it or revise it. And to be honest, I don't know the case well enough to know whether a group could actually revise the code. Perhaps they could, but it would, you have to bring a lot of people. So you don't have a single entity. But here's what I think is going to happen. I think we're going to see our concepts of the law stretched, bent, and molded to accommodate this new reality. And I'm already starting to see it in England. And frankly, I think we're seeing it here in the US with this SEC's notion of what is a security, with their adamant and completely unrelenting mantra that tokens are securities. Tokens, the object of the investment contract, the object of those business negotiations that the court for, since the Howey test, since SEC v. Howey, has said that the negotiations are the security, not the object, not the oranges, right? We all know about the Howey test and the oranges, but the SEC has taken the position that no, those tokens, that object embodies the negotiations, the security. What? What? That's just sort of stretching the law like taffy. I mean, well beyond. At some point, taffy isn't taffy, right? Is it still taffy when it's like 1,000 miles long? I don't know. It's something. Taffy has... Yeah, anyway, so I think what we are going to see more and more is courts, judges, regulators taking the rules. And we're going to have to say, you know, as a society, are we okay with that? And the judges as well, because these cases will be appealed. Are you okay? And courts are going to balance just as if they've always done. Well, maybe we need to change the rules. Maybe the rule needs to be modified. Maybe we need to think about this differently, given the risk. That's what we saw in England in the Tulip Trade case. In that case, you have a plaintiff, and I'm going to give you just the most salient, the basic facts, but the plaintiff said, you know, I can't get to my Bitcoin. I'm still fussing my keys. Can't get there. I'm suing the Bitcoin coders, data fiduciary duty to me, because they knew, they coded, they knew that, you know, I could potentially lose my keys and they should have created a backdoor, or they have the ability to change the code so I can get my value, my Bitcoin. And the trial court said, no way. You can't impute fiduciary duty on people who are just sort of doing their thing without, you know, you kind of have to sign up to be a fiduciary. And on appeal, the judges were like, well, yeah, under traditional law, I don't see it, but maybe we should have a new type of fiduciary duty law, because maybe we can think about this differently, given the facts and circumstances.
It's what's so interesting about common law. I mean, you have this flexibility responsiveness that can interpret things as they change. But as you say, the taffy analogy I really like, when it pulls so far in one direction, it needs discussion. It needs not just a legal debate, but also a political debate. And we've seen, I think the US has had a few bills go to Congress, if not get passed, to look at how do we potentially reform some of these structures and say, provide the clarity, whose responsibility?
Nothing's gotten passed.
Yeah.
Nothing. So here's the thing, like right now, there are two bills floating around pertaining to stable coins. I think they're going to come together. I'm hopeful because I think stable coins, at its core, we all have a basic idea of how stable coins should be regulated. And every jurisdiction that has regulated stable coins in the world have focused on the same core concepts, which is reserves, one-to-one. And don't rehypothecate. Don't take those reserves and use them for something else. Like, don't do it. Redeemability. You should be able to get your money back. You're a token holder. Boom, get your money back within a timely, like, and you shouldn't have to jump through hoops to get your money back. Like, it's not like you have to sign up for some platform and then, no, you get your money back. And so, yeah, and the reserves shouldn't be in something risky. And they should, not only should there be reserves, but they should be held in a safe way. Like bankruptcy remote entity and or in trust for the token holders. So if the stablecoin issuer goes bankrupt, those reserves aren't swept up into the bankruptcy estate, right? Although, given the banking failures in the states, you wonder, well, where do I actually put those reserves? Because what if the banks aren't safe? I mean, that's unfortunate, but that's where we are here in the US. But yeah, so those are the core principles. They're not really, you know, controversial. But it's on the edges. It's on the edges. Oh, and they shouldn't segregate. Don't segregate the reserve. But that's really a part of like having them separate, right? And not being used as collateral for other loans and other investments. But in the US, you know, there are certain other provisions that are being added, like community development. That's really a holdover from community banks. So like why, you know? So I read both bills. I'm hopeful that they can reach a compromise. I think that would really, oh, the other, in the states, one of the big provisions where they're sort of haggling over is, do the states get to regulate issuers at the state level or is it only at the federal level? You know, states in banks in the US, there's a dual regulation. You probably know this very well, right? It's your business. But states can grant licenses to banks. There's a regulation, the regulation is by both the federal and the state. But question is, can states allow companies to issue stable coins? I think they should. But at the Fed level, there's concerns about that. Like maybe only the Feds should have the power and they're the only ones who have the ability. And oh yeah, that was also another provision that I remember that like basically in one of the bills, like the Feds could change their mind at any time based on basically anything and take away the license because of economic factors. I'm using air quotes. Nobody can see me. But so that was a bit of a concern because that's the exception that could swallow the rule. And it would be very hard, I think, for companies to build a business where a federal regulator could decide like at any time that maybe the stable coins aren't good for the economy or aren't a good thing and rescind the license. I don't think that would happen, but, you know.
It's very interesting. I mean, the CBDC discussion as well, it's fascinating in its own right. I'd love to hear, I know, the Loomis Gillibrand bill did not pass. From an outsider's perspective, it sounded like one of the sensible opportunities to provide clarity in terms of who owns what and how do we work together. Do you think there's life or second life in something like that coming through? And where are we with the different discussions?
So I want to give a call out to my friend Chris Land. He was the primary drafter of that bill. He works for Cynthia Loomis. I think that bill was a landmark. I mean, even though it wasn't passed, because you're right. It was very smart. It was very sensible. It touched a lot of different issues. I mean, it didn't touch. It addressed a lot of issues. It was reasonable. It was comprehensive. So what it did, what I think the most important thing it did was get down on paper sort of best in class solution for so many issues. And there are folks who said that it didn't go far enough. Okay, so add to it. So I think we are going to see iterations of different aspects of this bill in different legislation. So I think he did a remarkable job and he really did capture the best because I know that they spoke to a lot of people from that office. I mean, Senator Loomis is a Republican and they were working with Democrats and Republicans and they want again, like trying to reach that balance. And I think that's what they were doing. Wyoming was the first state to think hard about decentralized systems and digital assets and how do you revise the current statutory framework to enable these products, this property, this technology to continue to grow, to not kill it, but to create responsible guardrails. They were the first jurisdiction to really do that in a broad way, in a comprehensive and smart way. That was led by Caitlin Long, who's been just like a tremendous innovator and pioneer now with her own business and trying to keep her business moving forward in the right direction and getting the regulators to do the right thing. So this legislation, we will see it in different forms, but I would say Chris did us and Senator Loomis did a tremendous service, along with Senator Gillibrand of New York in putting that bill together. Yeah, we will see this. It will. And frankly, this bill is being studied globally. So not only in the United States, but others. It takes, you know, it really takes a pioneer with thick skin to think long and hard about how to make this all work and to not be afraid. Oh, I know what I was going to say. You know, the legislation in Wyoming pertaining to using digital assets as collateral in secured lending, they were the first. Again, Chris worked on that along with Caitlin and many others. But initially, it was attacked. And they were attacked. And the folks working on that bill, they got called out and it was vicious. I actually wrote a couple of articles about it for Forbes.com because it was incredible. But slowly, people, once they became less afraid and their guard was down and they were willing to look, you know, they realized there were some important principles that they were addressing. And we have a new UCC Article 9 Uniform Commercial Code template law that is being reviewed and adopted, but that largely accepts most of the ideas. And I suspect over the next few years, this model law addresses, you know, digital assets and it'll likely be adopted in all 50 states. That's how it happens.
Baby steps.
But it happens. You can't be afraid to, can't put your head in the sand because it's going to happen. The technology is out. The businesses are being developed. There's great opportunity. And especially, you know, we don't see what's happening in certain countries that don't have fully developed or secure and stable economic systems or in war-torn countries. They are embracing this technology because it's a matter of, I mean, it could be a matter of life and death, but it improves their lives. So it's happening.
I had the privilege of seeing you at last year's consensus and also meeting Caitlin. I think a lot of us are watching what she's doing very closely and wishing her the best. And also wishing that the Loomis Gillibrand bill kind of gets through in some shape or form. Because for us, and speaking wearing my UK hat right now, having the US be a strong center of innovation, where historically all of the unicorns or nearly all of the unicorns in the crypto space are based in the US, helps international centers to also come take comfort and build their own cohort of businesses. I'm going to zoom straight into New York because I know that in the US, the state of New York is obviously a big influence and as the financial center of New York City is firmly located there. And I know you were recently there.
Yes, I was in Albany, New York yesterday.
Having a good time, it seems.
You know, it was very exciting to be there because I grew up in New York on Long Island. And although I'd been to Albany, I had never been in the seat of power. Not that I was in the seat of power, but I was observing how power and laws are made. And that was a tremendous thrill for me to just be a part of it. Yeah, I was there yesterday. There was a hearing sponsored or organized by two assembly committees. There's in New York, it's bicameral. They have a assembly and a Senate. And so this was the assembly. And it was a banking committee and a committee that protects the interests, consumer interests. And they were hosting this hearing to learn more, to do research on cryptocurrencies and to understand how the industry could be made more secure and transparent. I was there testifying on behalf of a global blockchain business council. There were several folks testifying, including the superintendent, Adrian Harris. There were also representatives from the AG's office, from Elliptic, and from other trade organizations and private citizens who had knowledge about the topic, or if they didn't have knowledge, they had very, very strong opinions. I mean, there were folks who just thought New York should just kill crypto. There's no redeeming feature. Just kill it, kill it, kill it. And we, you know, everyone's voice was heard. I thought the legislators, the assembly members, the chairs of both committees, I was really impressed. I was impressed with their knowledge. I was impressed with the questions they asked. It was clear they had read materials. They had an intimate knowledge of not just the industry, but where there were gaps in the current regulation that needed to be filled. The topics, for me, tended to focus on one of two areas. One was, how do we reduce the scamminess of crypto? There are too many scams. There's too much fraud. What do we do about this? And all I can think about is how people are getting catfished on dating apps. Like, what are we doing about that? What are we doing about the emails people get from, you know, these heartbroken or send me your money and I'll, I mean, yes, it's, there's scamminess everywhere. And I totally get that there's terrible fraud in crypto, but so that was a concern. The other concern they had was about the loopholes and the gaps in the current regulation and what should be done should the current regime, which is the BitLicense, which is a pretty demanding regulatory regime, should that be scrapped? Should it be amended? Should it be supplemented by a second regulatory regime proposed by the Attorney General's office? And that's really what the hearing was about. It was several hours. It was more than 3 hours, almost 4 hours. My position, my personal opinion, and the position of Global Blockchain Business Council, which has, you know, 500 members globally, our members, we have banks, we have Fortune 500 companies, we have innovators, we have layer one foundations. I mean, really, lawyers, consulting companies. We have just a huge swath of organizations, including regulators and regulators around the world and educators. Our belief is that let's do some research, include your private industry, understand what the loopholes or the gaps are, and see the best way to fill it. We need to do research. We need to have the data. We need to understand the risk. What is the risk? How is that risk translating into damages or potential, you know, other damages? And yeah, let's pay attention to that. But, you know, the AG, the New York AG, has proposed sweeping regulations that would just hamstring the industry. And we just like, wow, let's take a step back. But it was interesting to me because most of the folks there thought that would be the right approach. There were folks who were clearly concerned about fraud. So there was someone there from, represented from AARP, and she spoke about the vulnerability of older Americans, which of course they are, and how they're subject to so much fraud and their goal, you know. And she said, listen, just do whatever you can to make this stop. You know, that was really her testifying. And again, there was someone else there who just was like, crypto is bad. There's no redeeming feature. Stop crypto. I think almost everybody else, except for the representatives from the AG's office, said, no, we need more enforcement. We need more. This bill will. Their position actually was there's a inherent conflicts in the way exchanges are currently structured. We, crypto exchanges are structured. We need to remove that conflict by making sure that exchanges choose one line of business. Either they're a marketplace, or they're a broker, or they're an advisor, or you're an issuer, you issue tokens. You can't do both. You can't be a broker on both sides of a transaction. And first of all, not you can't be, and none of your affiliates can be. So in their bill, even though you have exchanges that are duly licensed and other businesses that are duly licensed under the BitLicense, all of those, I think 30 somewhat entities would basically have to reimagine their business model, rethink their organization, and somehow sell off bits and pieces. If it would even work, like, I don't know how that works. But the idea that a broker can't trade on its own account, broker, but they're saying like, listen, there's this conflict of interest. It's structural and it's got to be fixed. That's the opinion of the AG. They also have some other, I think, draconian measures to stop what they would perceive as, let's say, deceptive marketing or wash trading. part of that bill also includes a provision to prevent anyone who owns $25,000 of crypto from posting, from tweeting about that security without first registering with the state of New York and paying a fee, like $200 fee, whatever it is. So there was a lot of focus on that, which to me, that seems pretty extreme. And then, you know, I was actually grilled at the end of my testimony, which largely was very amicable. I was asked, do you agree that we need a statute on predatory marketing? What? Predatory? Against predatory marketing? And I'm a lawyer. I'm like, what is he talking about, predatory? I mean, that's a range of, what does that even mean? And so I said, well, we would have to be concerned about, you know, infringing on people's First Amendment rights, because I'm thinking about the statute, right, that the proposal. I'll take that as a no. And actually, it was interesting because I was looking, I had some screens open. I had about 100 screens open this morning as I was closing the screens. And I saw that there's actually a statute in the bid license that prevents deceptive and other types of untrue marketing with respect to cryptocurrency. So again, I'm not sure, you know, maybe that statute needs to be bulked up, but I got grilled at the end. So if anybody watches that hearing, I was just doing my best.
I think you can handle it. I think it's so interesting to hear the way you describe, and this is a very kind of local discussion, obviously. It's quite a big locality, but the same debates are happening here and you hear the same types of views. And I think this is healthy. It's good in a democracy to have people speak up.
So healthy. That's yeah. Why I was so happy to be there. I was so proud, really. I was so proud of the assembly members who were there. They were there to the bitter end. I believe her name is Pamela Hunter, who was the chair of the committee. She, to the bitter end, was asking questions. And I knew they were all tired. Yeah, I want to call out Neely Rosick. She's the assembly chair on the Committee on Consumer Affairs and Protection. And then Pamela Hunter, she's the chair of the Committee on Banks. She was thoughtful. They both were thoughtful. Everyone was tired. And she's like, well, tell me, what do you think we should do differently? How can we protect? Like, should we change? What should we change? Where are the gaps? To the very last witness testifying, like, I just felt really like, yes, this is a democracy. And I thought they were genuine.
Yeah, I mean, it's lovely to hear, but it is messy. I think we all know that.
That's how I started.
Yes, exactly. But the level of sophistication is definitely increasing. And I think we are seeing in our representatives a level of understanding, which is light years ahead of where it was. But that's reflective of society generally as new things unfold. I'm mindful of your time as well.
Yeah.
And I was hoping, we've covered a lot of ground, if you could just share some closing words, some things that are at the fore of your mind to wrap.
I think that it's easy to get discouraged in this space, but when things seem impossible, you just take a break. Don't stay on Twitter or LinkedIn. Take a break, deep breath, and then come back to it. But nothing, you know, it's things that are important are hard. Nothing comes easily. So yeah, just keep moving forward. If we keep moving forward, we'll get there.
Thank you. I mean, your enthusiasm is infectious. And thank you very much, Andrea, for everything you're doing. Also, Global Blockchain Business Council, all the good efforts to educate and inform. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Sean.